Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Sociology on the New Books Network. We are
Ellis Jones, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts.
And Jerry Lemke, Emeritus Professor of Sociology at Holy Cross. Our guest for this edition is Leah Cohen, and we'll be talking with her about her newest novel entitled No Book But the World. It's a work of fiction with themes on education and learning philosophy that we think make it a perfect fit for course syllabi on sociology of education, learning theory, and those wonderful, if all too rare, offerings on sociology of fiction or sociology through fiction.
I'm actually teaching one of those courses in the fall. It's sociology through science fiction called Utopian and Dystopian Worlds. Leah also wrote the highly acclaimed The Grief of Others, the nonfiction Glass Paper Beans, along with, as far as we know, at least seven other books, including both fiction and nonfiction. Currently, Leah is the Jenks Chair of Contemporary American Literature at Holy Cross, and we are very pleased to be with her for the next 50 minutes.
Leah, you begin your novel, No Book But the World, with an epigraph from Rousseau. Can you tell us what that epigraph is?
Yes.
And why you chose it?
Yes. The epigraph is, "Let there be no book but the world." And the full quote is, "Let there be no book but the world and no instruction other than fact." And that's from Rousseau's Emile, or A Treatise on Education. And I chose it because it figures centrally in the novel.
Mm-hmm. Rousseau's very 18th century. Besides just these intriguing words to use, what do you think Rousseau has to say to us today in the 21st century about education? You might even want to comment on gender, since he had many of his ideas on education were very gendered ideas. Can you say a little bit more about Rousseau and what your interest might be?
Right. So maybe it would help to tell you how I first came to hear of Rousseau. I'm not a scholar. I've never studied sociology or philosophy or really most disciplines in a formal way. So I came by Rousseau when I was 18 and I was working at sort of a summer camp / summer school. And one of the greatest things about working at this program was meeting the other staff members. It was this really vibrant, energetic group of young people, college students, studying in all different disciplines. And I remember one evening, one summer evening, taking a walk with these, comrades, these colleagues, and this one guy I remember explaining about Rousseau. And as he put it, he was sort of extrapolating, I think, from Emile and coming up with his own example, because then many years later I read Emile and I didn't quite find this example. But he said what Rousseau thought was, for example, you shouldn't give a kid an apple and say, "This is an apple, it's a piece of fruit, you can eat it." what Rousseau believed was you should give a kid an apple and say nothing and let the kid experience the apple herself, right? You know, and sort of smell it and feel it and toss it in the air and bite into it and all of this. And this, you know, the empirical discovery of life through, as I just said, experience rather than through formal instruction. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as I heard, you know, oh, about this guy Rousseau and that's what he believed in, it clicked with me and it made me think of A.S. Neal, who was a figure I did know of while I was growing up. And so years later when this book began to take shape for me, A.S. Neal and Jean-Jacques Rousseau were sort of two important guides.
Mm-hmm. I thought when you said summer camp and summer school that there might be some connection with Summer Hill, the free school movement. Yeah.
Yeah, and there you go. The connection is there.
Maybe we can take that into talking more specifically about your book. Fred is one of your characters. Ava is one of your characters. Their parents are important. There's a lawyer in your book. Can you tell us briefly about each of those? Then maybe that provides us with a good introduction to the book, and then we can talk about some other things.
Sure. So the main character and the principal narrator is Ava, this young woman, and she's telling a story involving her brother Fred. And even though the story is set when they're young adults, an awful lot of the book pulls back into Ava's memories of their childhood. And so we learn a lot about their unconventional childhood. Their parents were educators who ran a free school modeled after the real-life Summer Hill that A.S. Neal founded and ran in England. And Ava and Fred grew up on the grounds of the school after it was no longer running. But with their parents allowing them and encouraging them to sort of live fully the life of Rousseau's hypothetical Emile, you know, kids whose learning is all self-directed and experiential rather than in the form of formal pedagogy. And you mentioned the lawyer, so maybe it would be helpful if I just say when the book opens, Ava has learned that Fred is being held in jail. He's suspected of a crime. He was the last person to see alive a young boy who has been found dead in the woods with signs of abuse on his body. And so Ava is sort of hurtling toward Fred, who's being held in this small town in upstate New York, with the belief that she alone might be able to reconstruct the story of what happened from Fred and then explain to everybody else, to the world, who her brother is and that he's not monstrous.
Would you mind actually picking a passage and reading it for us? I'd love to hear it in your own words, unless you have one memorized.
Sure. Maybe I would read from the scene where Ava's been trying unsuccessfully to get into the jail to see Fred, and then she finally does see him. And this scene is actually, it's written in the third person from Fred's perspective. The man said, "Get up, you have a visitor." He figured it would be the lawyer again, who came yesterday, but they went down a different hall, and the man brought him to a different room. Instead of one table and two chairs, this one had a bunch of tables and a bunch of chairs, and a lot of people sitting at the different tables. Not just men in greens, but women and some kids, too. Some of the people were wearing regular clothes, like skirts and sweatshirts. Some were dressed fancy. One woman was wearing a red dress and sharp red shoes, like she was going to a fancy restaurant. He was standing there just looking at some babies, and there were people talking Spanish and people talking English and people talking something else he didn't know what. And one man and woman, they were both crying and neither of them using any tissues, just their sleeves. It was funny seeing all these different kinds of people after days of having everybody be a man and everybody dressed the same, either in blue uniforms weighed down with buttons and badges and zippers and snaps, all that sharp, shiny metal that made you blink, or else like him in these loose green pants and loose green shirts that hung off you and smelled of cooked peas, and these black rubber sandals that weren't his either. Where were his shoes? He couldn't remember. He was blinking his eyes, looking around the bright fluorescent room, searching for the lawyer. He remembered the lawyer from yesterday, or maybe the day before, a tall, sit-up straight man with little glittering eyes in his big doe face that hung in folds around his neck. The man who brought him in said, "Don't see your visitor," and he shook his head no, but then he saw her. His throat went clink, like he was a metal bank and someone had stuck a big coin through the slot. He had never called Ava because her number was in the little book back at Dave's house on the Cape, and he didn't know how she'd figured out where he was or what happened or how to find him or anything. He didn't know how she'd gotten herself here or how she could have known to come, but Ava always knew stuff he didn't know. Seeing her made him feel happy and scared. He started to rub his hands on the side of his pants. She was wearing a sweater that was brown and pants that were gray. Some birds were brown and gray, and he wanted to tell her, "Hey, you look like one of those birds." But he saw that she had seen him now, too, and her eyes went all tilty like a roof that was too steep. She started to stand up, and the man behind him said, just like he was cracking a stick over his knee, "Ma'am." And she sat back down, and the man said, "That your visitor?" And he nodded, and the man said, "You go sit over there. Remember, no touching."
That was wonderful.
Nice.
You know, I noticed that two of your books have been turned into audiobooks. And I was wondering if you had ever considered reading your own books in audio form for your readers.
Yeah, I am. I love to read out loud, and I also love to be read, too. I love hearing people's voices, you know, animate the stories. I've not been invited to record one of my books, but maybe someday.
You know, I've also noticed that in a lot of your work, you harken back to childhood. And I was wondering, now that you look back, can you identify some of the first moments in which you can now, seeing your younger self, identify that those were the moments that started you on the path to being a writer?
I do know that the impulse to tell stories and also just play with words started very young, before I could write. My mother would write down stories and poems that I made up orally. So that was there so far back that I can't really trace it to a source. You know, it just seemed to be there from the beginning.
Do you still have any of those?
I have some. Yeah, there's one little notebook that my mom kept for me that I still have. Yeah. But I do think that really in all my books, the fiction and the nonfiction, a preoccupation that shows through is a sense that storytelling is for connecting with those that we might naturally perceive as being other. Mm. And I do see, I mean, my childhood was a little bit unusual in how much otherness it contained, in that I'm hearing, but I grew up at a school for the deaf. My nuclear family is racially mixed, and my father is Jewish, my mother was Protestant. So there were, you know, even within our sort of traditional family structure, there was this sense of otherness and and commonality between groups that are often seen as distinct. So that aspect of my childhood, I think, has continued into my writing.
I saw a quote, actually, earlier that you had said, "I love novels and short stories and poetry. I started when I was very little. I named my fingers, and they had personalities and dialogue and character. The elements of theater and narrative took hold of my imagination before I could write." And so I was curious, do you still remember your fingers' names?
they were made-up names. I remember Chula and Sarsi, and, you know, they had these nonsense names. I guess maybe all names could be heard as nonsense names.
Yeah. I wonder if we can rename our fingers as we go through life, since we make them up.
That's a lovely
they
idea.
They become different figures for us as we go through life. Your question, or Ellis's question about reading your work, as well as writing your work, leads me to ask about different roles, the role of you as reader. You said you would like to read, and maybe read your own material. There's two other roles that you have, one as author, one as book critic. You do a lot of criticism in the New York Times specifically, which is where your books are also reviewed. I'm wondering about those two roles and what your thoughts are on those two different roles. And which of those roles do you think is most influential in American literary culture? Maybe it comes down to, if you really had to be one or the other and only, which one do you think is the most efficacious, maybe in general, but also for yourself?
Wow, that's such a tough question. It's tough because I think being a critic in some ways seems clearly to be the most efficacious in terms of participating in a public conversation. And there's something really exciting and vital about being part of the conversation, whether it's little kids getting to draw a chair up to the grown-ups table and participating in that conversation, or whether it's as an adult, you know, being offered a seat at the table of public discourse, right? It's and I don't kid myself that my novels and nonfiction books are very widely read. You know, I don't think that they would be missed if I weren't publishing. Not to say that my criticism would be missed, but at least with the criticism, I feel like I'm in dialogue with other people who are excited to think about and discuss books. That said, if I had to choose one, because the second part of your question was, you know, which feels the most vital to me, I would certainly choose, if I had to stop writing criticism, if that's what it took to keep inventing, to keep creating stories and ideas with words. And I'll say too, I don't regard, even though I love to read and I love to write, I don't regard literature as, there's nothing, I don't idealize the written word. I think the written word is the best tool that I have to sort of play, to be part of this activity that we get to do while we're here on Earth, which is sort of playing with the stuff of life and with how we can grow. Mm-hmm. But the only reason I'm a writer is because that's the tool that makes sense to me to get to do this other thing that really exists beyond words.
It actually
I just want to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Leah Cohn. She's the author of the new novel, No Book But the World, which is published by Riverhead Books.
I was going to ask, now that we're talking about these dual roles and dual worlds, I was interested, by my count, you have 5 books in the world of fiction and 5 in nonfiction. And to a certain extent, you almost seem to alternate back and forth. And I was wondering, what do you find satisfying about publishing in each of those worlds? What does it do for you?
Well, a little confession is that I always wanted to write fiction, and I never really dreamed of writing nonfiction until I found myself doing it. But I learned rather late how exciting and transporting narrative nonfiction could be. As a child, it was always fiction that did the job of transporting me. To that point, though, you know, once I sort of cottoned on to the fact that storytelling is storytelling, I think in some ways I don't feel that my nonfiction and my fiction are serving very different roles in my life. I guess I have a big appetite to experiment with form, you know, and so in that regard, to write only fiction and never get to tell true stories would feel like a bit of a loss, and vice versa. But in many respects, I feel like what it is that I'm trying to do with my books is the same, whether I'm writing fiction or nonfiction.
Well, we're certainly interested in the sociology that comes out of your books. And as I said in the introduction, sociology of education, learning theory, there's plenty of stuff on gender relations that come out of your books. But I'm also thinking that there might be something else that you have in mind that you want your readers to come away with, something else that you're trying to connect on. And I'm wondering how you would complete the sentence, "I really hope readers come away with blank." What goes in that blank for you?
I really hope readers come away with a sense of having been altered by virtue of their own openness to interacting with the ideas in the book. I've come to realize that for me, what has to happen to make the writing process feel successful is that I have to remain open to being shifted, changed by it. And more and more, I have come to speculate that books that are written, literature that's written in this way, where the writer is open to and as a result experiences change during the process of creating the book, I've begun to speculate as to whether those books tend more often to create a similar experience of expansion, shifting, growth, reversal, questioning, whatever, within the reader. And so that's the experience that that I crave and that I hope to be passing on.
Hmm. Going back to Rousseau for a minute and the title of your book, No Book But the World, is there any irony in the fact that you write books, right, and you choose that title for your book, and presumably there's some message there that the world is its own book?
Yes.
And Rousseau literally said, right, did he not, that education without books, that books were a problem, or something to that effect.
Yeah, yeah. He's quite disparaging of books Emil. It's true. Yeah.
Is there anything to be reconciled there between the book writer and a world without books?
You know, when I was writing Glass Paper Beans, which was my second nonfiction book, I remember actively, it's very important to me to be irreverent toward myself as a writer and toward the process. And the way that irreverence expressed itself during the writing of that book was I kept saying to myself and out loud, I don't really know if this is supposed to be a book. You know, maybe this is really supposed to be an interpretive dance or a watercolor or, I didn't want to be too fixed on the idea that, you know, well, the proper way to express what it is I'm hoping to express with this book is through literature. And yeah, I think similarly, this is this sort of willingness to consider breaking the rules or breaking the form. Right, there's almost this built-in joke with No Book But the World in titling the book that, and in maybe inviting all of us to think about whether there are other more robust and fluid ways of getting at some of these ideas and experiences.
You know, I think Jerry and I have both noticed that there might be a little bit of an anarchist streak in your writing. And so
I am honored.
So I was wondering if you would tell us a little bit about your anarchist tendencies, both in writing, but also maybe a story in the real world.
I'm trying on that word, you know, anarchist. I don't know if that applies. It may, but certainly, vigorous questioning and sort of, contrarian kind of irreverence, you know, all of that I will gladly, own. Yeah, in the real world, you know, I went to a communist summer camp. I went on lots of marches in Washington. I still danced at protests and in Nicaragua, performing for Sandinista soldiers at the front. I certainly do have, I guess I feel that I was blessed to grow up with parents who wished to introduce to their children a sense of expansiveness in how we regarded the world and our place in it, and taking little of the fixed, you know, mainstream sort of certainties of our society, you know, not taking those as gospel.
The New York Times reviewer of your book, I think, referred to some of the anarchistic qualities in it. I think it was in the last paragraph, which caught my eye, which also caught my eye. It was a very positive review. She used words like perceptive, empathetic, gripping, intriguing, and alluring. She also was critical of what she called a creative writing-y style. That's all one phrase. Speaking of creative writing, I've never seen that phrase. I'm wondering what you thought of that when you read that.
Yeah. It's interesting because she followed that criticism up with a pretty ample list of examples of the kinds of phrases that she objected to. And I went over that list of phrases to see if, in retrospect, I would cringe. Oh, I can't believe I said that, you know. and I didn't really have a problem. You know, one of them was redly silly. And it's maybe this is what you mean by anarchist. So to me, I understand that redly silly, you know, if I were in grade school and I handed that in a paper, it's likely the teacher would, you know, there would be some red ink on that page explaining about grammar. and to me, playing with what words can do, if it gets us closer to the true expression of what we feel, to me that feels like an important thing to allow ourselves to do, rather than, so if what she was objecting to were certain breaches of conventional grammar and syntax, I don't regret that I made those breaches.
You played guilty with honor.
I plead guilty with honor.
One of the scenes in your book that you described is when Ava's car becomes stuck on a muddy road, and a fellow stops to help her and gets behind the car. It's a rear wheel driven car, and he gets behind and he pushes the car out, and then. You describe him, or she, I guess it's her voice, describing him as looking Jackson Pollocked.
right.
After pushing the car out, and the reviewer did not like that, that phrase, and I loved it. And I thought, well, you know, she probably knows who Jackson Pollock is and what a Jackson Pollock painting looks like, but she's probably never stood behind a car on a muddy road and pushed it out and realized that I think that's a perfect expression. I just really liked it. I liked it when I read it. It really caused me to stop and kind of smile and think about that. And then to see that in the review as something that the reviewer didn't like made me kind of smile again.
I mean, I will say, I think sometimes I think I can tell when a writer is straining to come up with interesting descriptions.
Sure.
And certainly I would not plead guilty with honor to that. I mean, I don't ever want to be overreaching or straining to sound writerly. But when idiosyncratic turns of phrase occur naturally, then, you know, I think that's, I mean, there's this line from King Lear that I love, speak what we feel, not what we ought to say. And when I'm at my most sort of natural, fully realized self as a writer, that's what I feel is coming through. And what I hope is coming through to the reader.
You know, I keep hearing a kind of transformation through creativity theme as you speak. And I'm wondering if we go back to talking about the process of writing and what you hope your readers hear, it makes me think of Lewis Hyde's The Gift. And I'm wondering, what is the gift that you give yourself when you write? And then what is the gift that others receive? Particularly the former, though. What is the gift for yourself?
To me, there's, I think, no more pleasurable feeling than being able to receive and take what it is that I'm receiving and interact with it. Very much as a child would, in a state of seriousness and playfulness, and make something of the material I have received, and then send what I have made forth into the world. And so I realize I'm speaking abstractly, and I don't mean to be obscure, but to me, the experience of creative writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, is that experience of receiving ideas and stories and, you know, inspiration, if you will. And then spending time interacting with that stuff and then letting it go, sending it on its way again. That's just the best. And the second part of the question was...
The gift to others, the gift to your readers. I mean, you've already mentioned a little bit about how you'd like the experience of reading to alter them in some way.
I guess the way I would like the experience to alter them is by readers picking up this thing, this little, you know, paper boat or origami crane. You know, I often see it metaphorically as this little flimsy paper object that I've sent out into the world. For readers to be altered, not because there are instructions on this little origami crane, you know, that alter them, but because they pick it up and sort of maybe unfold it and fold it back together a different way. But in other words, that this gift, in Lewis Hyde's sense, this gift that I open myself up to receiving, spending time with, and then recirculating, that readers too will pick it up as something that they might exercise some agency over, or they might simply open themselves up to experiencing something that is their own individual experience that arises from that little paper object I set out into the world.
The reference to the little paper object, the origami, there's a lot of craft references in the things you write. Certainly the book, Beans.
Glass paper. Yeah.
Glass paper, beads, or beans.
Beans.
Yeah. I love that book. Because I have a little bit of background in sociology of work and labor, and I grew up in a working class family, and have some of those same appreciations. And in the new book, No Book But the World, your latest novel, there's a carpenter,
yeah,
in that. And when I was reading, another smile came to my face. There's Leah Cohen again writing about a craftsman, right? And a craft worker. I think that's wonderful. Where does it come from in your own? There must be something in your own background that's coming out there.
Yeah, I don't know. What comes to mind is I grew up without religion. So my dad was, Jewish but secular. And my mom had grown up in a Protestant household but was not at all religious by the time she had kids. And I remember when I was 18 coming home from college and seeing this little slip of paper that she had thumbtacked to the bulletin board that said, to labor is to pray, St. Thomas Aquinas. And I was like, Mom, what is it? Are you religious? Like, do you believe in God? And I at age 18 began to learn about, my mother's, even though she was not part of any organized religion, had a very strong sense of spirituality, but also spiritual questioning was just important to her, I think, on a daily basis, interacting with questions about that piece of our existence. But that particular quote, the idea that, look, I mean, I think creative work is akin to, if not synonymous with, prayer, right? You know, I mean, it's the same stuff. It's the same thing. And then the idea that to labor is to pray, you know, and it's so easy when you're a writer, you guys know this, it's so easy to just spend so much time in one's head. I think that's highly problematic. And I think handwork, you know, whether it's changing diapers or washing dishes or making paper craft or gardening or baking bread, whatever it is I feel it physiologically, I feel it to be spiritually important. So, I mean, I think that I had never thought about that point. I think it's lovely that you see little echoes of craft and handcraft in the books that I've written.
Yeah, in all of them, yes.
Yeah. It reminds me of the name of your blog, Love as a Found Object, again with that theme. And so how have you found playing with that form?
The blog form, yeah. So play is really the operative word there. One thing I told myself when I began this blog was that I would sit down to write an entry and I would click publish or whatever it is you click before I got up out of my chair again. In other words, I wouldn't labor too much on polishing it and bringing an idea through to fruition. And this idea of sort of finished product would not be part of the blog. It would be more like a sandbox, you know, to get in and dig around and play with my shovel and pail. And then I would set forth into the world unfinished pieces. And so this, the idea of allowing myself to play in a somewhat public forum and focus more on process and play than on product felt really wonderful.
And have you had much response from readers online?
Yes, over the I kept it for 6 years pretty regularly, and then for 2 years now it's been much more sporadic. But times when I've been really active with it, I've had a steady little stream of commenters and responders, which has felt like evidence of this, of the gift being in circulation.
We're talking with Leah Cohen, author of No Book But the World, her newest novel published by Riverhead Books. I guess I should say we have been talking with Leah. We have about 5 minutes left. Want to give us something good to end with?
Well, I'm wondering, are there any projects that you have kept in the back of your head that have seemed too far-fetched or too challenging for you to take on, but are kind of fantasy or dream projects that just kind of linger in the back of your mind? Is it that you, as you come up with each project, you dive in, or are there still projects that you've considered that you've never quite had the gumption to wrestle with?
It's funny. That sounds so inviting. You know, listening to your question makes me think, oh, what would that be? You know, something that if only I were to get the gumption, I could dive in.
Something with hammer and nail.
Right. Well, I will tell you, I'm working on a project right now, which is a first for me. I was invited to give a lecture in London this past winter, and I'd never been asked to do that before, and it was lots of fun writing a lecture. And I'm self-publishing it as a pamphlet, and I'm with the copy left symbol, not the copy right, but the copy left symbol. And just yesterday, I went out and bought tools to bind it with. It will be very tiny, a sort of humble object to hold in one's hands. And I'm going to sew the binding. So this is my project that I'm sort of, that feels like it's calling upon my gumption right now to dive in and make these pamphlets.
How can we get a copy?
I think in a week or 10 days, I may have copies, and I will certainly let you know. But the pamphlet is called The Fortress and the Fool, and people will be able to contact me for copies or inquiries at andthefool@verizon.net.
All right.
Wonderful.
Thanks a lot. Thanks again, Leah Cohen, for sharing time with us, talking about your book, No Book But the World. And we wish you the best of luck on your new venture.
Thank you so much.
Can't wait to see it.